But maybe down the road. Case taken under advisement.
I'm going to promote school.
That's you're right. All right, the sixth case is the United States versus Muratovic. There we go. Mr. Brindley.
May it please the court. My name is Bo Brindley, and I represent the defendant appellant, Seniza Muratovic. Mr. Muratovic appeals the validity of his guilty plea based on claims regarding the insufficiency of the facts presented. And I would first like to address the issue of the attempt and the substantial step. Now, the government's reply on the issue of the attempt correctly notes that the stated factual basis during the Rule 11 colloquy can be amplified by any facts in the government's version of the offense or they're adopted in the PSIR, pre-sentence report, which are not objected to by the defendant. I think the vital fact that is not, that wasn't stated at the Rule 11 colloquy during the factual basis and is not in the pre-sentence report is the fact that the government now alleges that this robbery was definitively taking place on December 8th of 2011. That Mr. Muratovic was never asked to affirm that. He never was given that proposition and the opportunity to object to it. The other thing that's not present in the pre-sentence report is the allegation that the reason that the surveillance was abandoned or the scheme was abandoned was because Mr. Muratovic was observed by people in the truck. This is another part of the argument the government presents in their response that is not in the pre-sentence report. So we can't say Mr. Muratovic agreed with those facts because he didn't object to the pre-sentence report when the pre-sentence report does not specifically assert either of those facts. And it is our position that without those facts, it is impossible to prove that you had evidence sufficient to establish a substantial step. What we have here is a situation where we know there was preparation, there was surveillance, but if we don't have a definitive time frame of when the actual robbery was to occur, then it seems to me it's impossible to show that what happened was not merely preparation and that it actually moved on to a substantial step. And it
actually,
is that
the facts of the December 8th surveillance were part of the original factual basis, weren't they?
The facts that there was a surveillance, but not that the robbery was going to take place on that particular day. That was never unequivocally stated to Mr. Muratovic to ask his agreement in the Rule 11 colloquy, nor was it in the pre-sentence report. So while it's true he did surveillance on December 8th, 2011, which was then abandoned, and then the scheme he didn't pursue further, the question in my mind...
Well, it wasn't just the surveillance. It was surveillance plus all the implements of the actual...
Right.
Crime, the tools necessary to complete it. Why isn't that enough?
I don't think that's enough. I don't think that's more than mere preparation if we don't have a connection between the temporal proximity between the preparatory acts and when the actual event is going to occur. I think without that, it's impossible to say logically it's more than just preparation if we don't even know when it's going to happen. And I think that's the central issue that makes it difficult, I would say impossible, to prove a substantial step here and makes the plea regarding the attempt invalid.
Well, Mr. Brindley? Yes. The inference that's being drawn from the facts of record as of that date, that they show up at this site, they have all the implements necessary to complete the crime, including the gas cans, the duct tape, the disguises, weapons, pepper spray, etc. Everything,
right.
Everything's there. They're there. They're doing the surveillance. The truck that is the target of the robbery is thought to be on its way. And so, everything's there. So it's not just the preparation. It's, but for what happened when the truck arrived.
But I don't think they were the facts regarding what happened when the truck arrived, the idea that these people saw him and that's why this was abandoned, that was also not something that was stated in the factual basis. That's also not something that's contained in the pre-sentence report.
Well, is attempt law, does it require an explanation for why the crime wasn't completed in order to find an attempt?
No, it doesn't require that we have an explanation for it, but it does require that we have sufficient proof to show that what they had done was more than just preparation. And I don't think you can do that unless it's clear, unless he agrees, as a matter of fact, that that was the day.
Well, he agreed that he was attempting to do that. And my big concern in this case is as interesting as, you know, trying to figure out when preparations ripened into an attempt, when does, you know, dawn turn into daylight, when do the foothills become mountains, it's that kind of problem.
Yeah.
And with that kind of problem, it seems to me that the plain error standard of review on this is your biggest obstacle. I'd like you to address that, and I'd like you to also address it in the context of a defendant who, if I understand correctly, got three levels off of the guideline calculation for accepting responsibility and not challenging on those issues, and it was praised by the judge for having done that.
Your Honor, I think the answer to that question in terms of the plain error standard here is I do think that if when you have a question of whether or not an attempt has occurred, I think that you do need to have a date certain when it was going to happen. I think in the absence of that, I think that's a mistake that is plain. I think that as a matter of logic, it must be. Because how can we know in any definitive way that something is more than mere preparation if we don't know and we don't have any agreement whatsoever on when specifically event would occur?
What you're telling us is that Judge Zagel was required to reject this plea being presented to him, correct?
I think he should have.
Ms. Brindley, didn't the pre-sentence report say that it was further part of the scheme that on or about the 8th of December, the defendants and Individual A waited for hours near the location of the truck for the occupants of the truck to leave? Isn't that pretty specific about an act in furtherance?
I think it's specific, but we're not talking about an act in furtherance. We're talking about a substantial step. I think it's certainly specific that that happened that day, but my argument regarding that factual allegation is that constitutes preparation, and I don't think unless they were also saying they did that on that day with the intent to do this that very day.
If you're
going to
rob a bank, and you're parked outside waiting for the bank to open,
yes,
that's still all just preparation?
And well, it depends on whether or not you agree to that fact that you were intending to rob the bank that day. You may be standing outside the bank that day to watch, to see, so then you can come back to the bank another day because of whatever reason. But I think then that is mere preparation. But if it is your, in fact, intent, and you go to the court and they ask you, were you going to rob the bank on the day you were sitting in the car outside? And you say, yes, I agree with that. That's what I was going to do.
Would you say the missing link here is a failure of an inquiry by the district judge to say, if you weren't observed, you would have gone forward?
I think that would have done it. I think an inclusion of the fact in the factual basis during the Rule 11 colloquy that it was this date when you intended to go through with the act, I think that would have done it, or even that in the PSIR without an objection, I think that would have done it. But I think in the absence of those things, we don't have a substantial step. And so if there are any further questions, I would reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Brownlee. Mr. Burke.
May it please the Court, Matt Burke on behalf of the United States. On the early morning hours of December 8, 2008, the defendant, Sinisha Muradovich, was captured on tape at 2:51 a.m. stating, and I quote, "I am telling you that we will have him this evening. He is ours this evening, man, no matter what. Whether I had to kill him or not, we will take everything from him, man. The man has money, man," unquote. That is from page 20 of Exhibit 2 to the government's version, which was attached to the PSR and not objected to by the defendant at any point in the district court proceedings. So What the defense has argued here today is that the one missing fact is that there wasn't evidence of proximity in time. There wasn't evidence about an agreement about a specific day. But in fact, the record does demonstrate quite clearly that the defendant specifically said it was going to happen that day, no matter what, and that if necessary, he would kill the occupants of the truck if that's what it took to complete the robbery. So even if proximity and time, imminence, was the test, and I don't believe that it is the test under this court's law, it's clear that the defendant did take a substantial step towards the commission of the robbery. Because remember, this is the same evening on which the defendant, Sinisha Muradovich, had recruited Individual A to participate in this scheme, had explained the scheme to Individual A, had explained how the robbery would occur, had explained that they would be bringing two guns and that they would only rob the truck after it crossed state lines. It's the same night that he and his co-conspirators went and picked up two loaded firearms that the defendant admitted in his plea colloquy and has set forth in the PSR and in the recordings that they intended to use at a minimum to threaten the occupants of the truck. It's the same night that he and his co-conspirators, in the middle of the night, drove to a store twice to buy all of the supplies, the duct tape to bind and restrain the occupants, the pepper spray to incapacitate the occupants, the clothing to be used as disguises, the gas cans that they then filled with gasoline specifically for the purpose of following this truck until it stopped at a rest station outside of Illinois, at which point they were going to rush towards the truck, demand money, and use actual force or violence if necessary. So all of the facts that are set forth in the PSR and the government's version and in the defendant's plea colloquy demonstrate quite clearly that there was a substantial step and that the district court did not plainly err in entering judgment on that plea. And the one fact that the defendant claims is missing, again, comes from his own mouth, recorded on tape at 2:51 a.m. on the morning of December 8th, where he said, it's going to happen tonight.
And that was submitted at what juncture?
That's at page 20 of Exhibit 2 to the government's version, which was attached to the government's version and attached itself to the PSR.
And there was so after the plea?
After the plea, but before entry of judgment on the plea. And as this court has held repeatedly, the district court, in deciding whether there's a sufficient factual basis, can consider not just the plea colloquy, but the PSR and other factual allegations that are either adopted or not objected to by the defendant. And here we have a situation in which we have a draft translation of the recording of the defendant's own statements, where he did not supply his own defendant's version. He did not object to this in any way. It was attached to and referred to by the PSR. And before the district court, the defendant specifically stated that he had no objections to the PSR. So that is in the record, and it provides ample support in addition to all of the other steps that the defendant took to demonstrate that he did, in fact, take a substantial step. Now, again, the defendant has argued in his reply brief and has argued here today that the other fact that's missing is that the defendant didn't leave the scene because he had been spotted on counter-surveillance. But I think the only reasonable reading of the record is that that's exactly why he left. We have not only what's in the PSR and what the defendant admitted in his post-arrest statement, which itself was attached to the PSR as part of the government's version. We also, again, have his own statements captured on tape in the early morning of December 8th, 2008. Now, this is from page 43 of Exhibit 2 to the government's version, where the defendant is quoted as saying, "An old man, you know how he was looking at us, bro?" And then his co-defendant, Dosen, says, "Hey, we should go from here." And then the defendant says, "Hey, Domenico," referring to his co-conspirator, Domenico Alezzi. His co-conspirator, Domenico Alezzi, then says, "Yeah." And the defendant then responds, "Get out of here." So when you look at this in context, it's clear that that is the reason why he left the scenes, because he was afraid that the drug dealer that he was intending to rob had spotted him. He'd been burned on counter-surveillance. And so going through with the robbery at that particular moment would have been extraordinarily dangerous. And so they recalibrated. They backed off. And so that demonstrates what we have here is clearly a substantial step. And the two flaws, or the two alleged flaws that the defense points to in the reply brief, which frankly aren't flaws under the law, but even if they were, are refuted by the record. They're refuted by the defendant's own recorded statements, which were a part of the record and were not objected to by the defendant in the district court in any way. Now, turning back to the question of interstate nexus, there, too, the district court did not plainly err in entering judgment on the defendant's plea because there was ample support to demonstrate that there was a sufficient interstate nexus to support the Hobbs Act convictions. The defendant himself, as noted in the PSR, called Individual A in the early morning hours of December 8th and explained to Individual A how this robbery would occur and specifically explained that they wouldn't rob this truck until after it crossed out of Illinois. His co-conspirators are captured.
Why not?
Why
did they care?
Well, I think, Your Honor, what's suggested from the transcript, which is in the record, is that they wanted to wait until it was out of Illinois so that their victims wouldn't suspect who did it. That their victims wouldn't suspect that it was someone from the Chicago area if they robbed this truck outside of Illinois. And in specific, I think it's his co-conspirator, Milchkin Dosen, mm-hmm. who says, especially if we hit them outside of Illinois, they'll never know what hit them. They'll never suspect. And on the recordings, they talk about, specifically co-conspirator Milchkin Dosen talks about how this truck always goes the same way. It always crosses the southern border of Illinois, goes through Oklahoma, and then from there on to California, where it purchases, in his words on the recording, purchases the grass, and then brings the grass back to the Chicago area for distribution, and that they're going to wait until after it's outside of Illinois before they rob the trucks. Now, the defense says, well, this isn't sufficient because we haven't demonstrated that the truck, in fact, was engaged in interstate commerce. But this court has squarely rejected that argument. As this court held in Bailey, the government's burden in a conspiracy or an attempt case is not that the robbery, in fact, would have affected interstate commerce. It's merely to demonstrate that if the facts were as the defendant believed them to be, the robbery would have affected interstate commerce. And the clearest enunciation of that holding is in Bailey, because in Bailey, the victim of the robbery was not engaged in interstate commerce. The victim of the robbery there was an undercover FBI agent who had been posing as a cocaine dealer, but who, in fact, wasn't selling cocaine, didn't have money from the proceeds of cocaine, and the money involved wasn't for the purchase or sale of cocaine. And on appeal in that case, the defendant said, well, there's no effect on interstate commerce because the person that I robbed wasn't really a cocaine dealer. And this court said very clearly, no, that doesn't matter. What matters is that you intended to rob somebody who you thought was a cocaine dealer. And if you had been correct, that robbery would have affected interstate commerce. The facts of this case are indistinguishable from Bailey. In fact, the facts here are stronger because in Bailey we knew definitively that the victim was not engaged in interstate commerce. Here we have every reason to believe that the intended victims very likely were engaged in interstate commerce because the defendant, based on his own surveillance and based on information from his co-conspirator, had information that this truck regularly traveled to California. The one case that the defendant cites in response is the case of United States versus Watson. Watson provides no support. It doesn't overrule Bailey. It doesn't address anything about how to deal with a conspiracy or an attempt. And so Watson provides no support for the defendant's argument. Just very briefly on the last issue, the 924C, as we point out in our brief, the court doesn't need to reach that issue because the defendant did not argue below and has never argued on appeal that attempted Hobbs Act robbery is not a crime of violence. And the 924C conviction was supported both by the attempt conviction and the conspiracy conviction. So the defense has waived any argument that attempted Hobbs Act robbery is not a crime of violence. And because the attempt conviction must stand, his 924C conviction likewise must stand. If there are no further questions, the government asks that this court affirm on all counts.
Thank you, Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Brindley?
Regarding the quotations the government cites, what the government does is they cite specific quotations for Mr. Muratovic from the government's version of the offense, and they cite the page number of the government's version of the offense. The problem is, when you do a federal sentencing, the judge never asks you, do you have any objections to the government's version of the offense? They ask you if you have any objections to the pre-sentence report. The pre-sentence report did not set forth those specific quotations in that way. Well, it
right,
cites
but
certain
this issue
pages.
Was never raised, and so when we're considering a plain error argument,
yes.
Is it unreasonable for us to look at that information to see whether, if the issue had been raised, what might have happened?
I don't think so, because it is our position, Your Honor, that when you have a situation like this where none of the factual allegations specify the date specific in an attempt case, someone needs to ask that question or someone needs to allege that fact and make the defendant say yes or no. Otherwise, it's our position that the facts are insufficient to establish a substantial step.
I thought there was a defense sentencing memorandum that was filed that indicated that there was no objection to the government's version.
I think that the only thing the sentencing memorandum would ever assert is that there's no objection to the pre-sentence report. If it says that there's no objection to the... I honestly don't know the answer to your question if that's what they said. It would be my position that would be a bad thing to ever say if you were filing a sentencing memorandum. But
you didn't say it in any event.
I did not, and I would not. Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask the conviction be reversed.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Brindley. Mr. Brindley, you have the additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment. And Mr. Burke, Mr. Fulton, you have the thanks to the court also for the government's presentation.
Yeah.
All right. The case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.